Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we hear from one of the GOP's top advisors on the new health care bill in Congress. How would it affect the Valley, and what's the thinking behind the sweeping changes to Medi-Cal and more? We'll also learn how Yosemite Rangers are hoping to reduce the number of bears killed each year. And to do that, they're turning to their iPads. We'll learn why visitors also play an important part of that effort. Plus, a celebration of a very famous boxcar in Kern County. We'll get the inside scoop on Boxcar Fest at the Kern Pioneer Village. That's all coming up later in our show. We begin today, though, with a look at President Trump's proposed budget and what local officials are saying about it. The so-called skinny budget aims to cut non-military discretionary spending. That may sound like a national issue, but Valley cities are also a big part of that budget picture. Our Jeffrey Hess spent the past week looking into what it would mean locally, and he joins us now. Jeffrey, welcome.
Thank you.
So, in short, what does it mean for Valley cities? Is this something that they're paying close attention to?
Extremely close attention to. Valley cities really, there's a mix of three pots of money that cities run on: the local funding, the state funding, and the federal funding. Now, a lot of that federal funding could be passed through, like health care for the poor or the elderly, but a lot of it is local control. It's for things like affordable housing and food stamps and infrastructure grants and things like clean water and clean air. So Valley cities are paying very close attention to it. I do want to point out, though, that the president doesn't just set a budget and that's what happens. Congress is the one who would have to write and then approve the budget that the president would sign.
Now, as you mentioned, there are sometimes strings attached to a lot of federal dollars. Many times those cities also get block grants and things from the federal government that they can use on specific projects that they choose in neighborhoods that are in need. And you have this happening in cities across the Valley, large and small, all sorts of different economies, City of Fresno, City of Clovis. What are cities looking at as far as the biggest changes to block grants? Grants. I know you talked to Jennifer Clark.
Yeah, she's the city's director of development
of Fresno.
And cities absolutely love these block grants because there are so many fewer restrictions on what they can do. The federal government says improve housing conditions in low-income areas, and the cities then get to decide on how to do it. So I spoke with Jennifer last night about how much the city gets and where it goes.
Community Development Block Grant, CDBG, funds Fresno at approximately $6.5 million a year. It varies from year to year depending on the formula. Primarily, our funds are used for our senior meal programs, our after-school youth programs, housing rehabilitation for homeowners, low-income homeowners and senior citizens, sidewalk and street repairs, those kinds of projects.
So a lot of pretty basic supplemental community improvements that go in that money goes into, and the Trump administration would like to see those block grants phased out, done away with.
There's also a big cut to housing and urban development. That department helps fund affordable housing. Some of that money goes to area cities. Some of it goes to housing groups. Fresno's in the middle of a housing crisis, you could say, with the slumlord issue really being the number one issue in the last mayoral election, and big changes that were just passed as Mayor Lee Brand's first legislative act. What does that mean for the city's efforts there?
Yeah, so HUD does a lot to incentivize and build low-income housing, which is good for two things. It's difficult to get developers to do it on their own, so that encourages people to build low-income housing, and it also helps to fight the city's homelessness problem by making housing available for people who otherwise might be on the street so that they can afford it. So I reached out to Cruz Avila, who's with the Poverello House, the biggest homeless shelter in Fresno, to see what is he thinking. Is he concerned that the reduction in affordable housing spending is going to lead to an increase in homelessness in the city?
When I look at that, I mean, if there's a shortfall or if there is cuts in funding, like I said, Fresno and the county and the community of Fresno has been such a unique place to live that some shape or some form, we will find that funding through a private donor, through a business, or through some grant that will subsidize some of that funding. And, you know, community always comes through. Fresno County is a great place to live and a great place to find that support.
So sounding optimistic, saying if the funding falls short, we'll find a way to mix it up. The only federal funding that the Poverello House gets is through HUD, and it's for Naomi's House, which is a single homeless women's shelter in the city. So that funding from the federal government goes to fund a homeless shelter for single homeless women.
The Trump budget would also eliminate the entire funding for the Interagency Council on Homelessness, one of 62 agencies that Trump hopes to eliminate in this budget. Any word from the city how concerned they are as far as the administration higher up, from the mayor or his spokesperson?
They really were kind of wanting to stay out of it. I don't think there's a whole lot of expectation that most of this is going to become actual law in the budget. So the word is that they're just going to go ahead and continue planning as usual. A lot of other cities are saying the same thing. But at the same time, the California League of Cities is speaking out very strongly opposed to this. They're very concerned that it's going to mess up municipal budgets, because the way they see it is you need a community outside of a city to support the things that make city life and people who live even in small cities more comfortable and more successful. So I spoke with Carolyn Coleman, who's with the California League of Cities, and she explained why she's concerned that the feds could be stepping away from their role in developing local communities.
You know, these resources that communities receive from the federal government, in no way will they get the total job done. But they do help build funding gaps, which when coupled with other resources can make the difference in there being a redeveloped neighborhood, make a difference in there being a summer youth job program for children in our communities, and on and on and on. So really, this is about not only of local governments doing what they're doing to step up and support families in their communities, but it's also reminding the federal government to step up and to support families in these communities.
Transportation projects are also another thing that are on the chopping block in this budget. Fresno has recently completed or is nearing completion on two projects under the Department of Transportation. Are there any other things that are going on there in that area that people are paying attention to?
Right. Those grants for bus rapid transit, the Fulton Mall, these help communities do big projects that they otherwise wouldn't be able to get. The one that a lot of people are concerned about, especially with the potential for California to go against the president on immigration and him to cut back funding in that way, is the Veterans Memorial Boulevard plan that the city really wants to build this massive overpass in the northwest section of the city, partly with high-speed rail funding and partly with federal Tiger grants. But if the decision is to get rid of those, or if the president wants to come down hard on California, then that really important what city leaders see as a very important infrastructure project could go by the wayside.
Now, most of the focus nationally on the Trump budget has been in the cuts. The infrastructure plan that President Trump has talked about is yet to be fully defined. Are there potential highlights, anything that the Valley people should pay attention to as a potential benefit or new federal funds flowing into the area?
Well, yeah, a big one would be if we could get some improvement on our highways. A lot of people are very aware that Highway 99 is very damaged, so there could be some interest in building new highways. Likely to be toll highways if the private companies are involved, but there could be a big infrastructure benefit in that way. There was also a proposal for a $54 billion increase in the military. Again, that's not line itemed where that would go, but it's not out of the realm of possibility that Lemoore might benefit in some way from that spending increase.
Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reporting on the local impact of the proposed budget released last week by President Donald Trump. Jeffrey, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. Awkward doesn't begin to describe the spot California Senate President Pro Tem Kevin De Leon found himself in last week at a rally for his bill that seeks to protect California immigrants from federal deportations. Advocates pressured the senator not to weaken the measure. But as Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler reports, he may have no choice if he wants it to pass.
Reset, win it! Reset, win it! The rally outside the state capitol wasn't half as big as the 1,500 people promised by organizers. But when Senate President Pro Tem Kevin DeLeon stepped on stage, leaders seized the moment.
To our senator, we need you to know something, Senator.
Fresno pastor DJ Kreiner was emceeing the event.
This is what we would like you to commit to. Can we count on you? Can we depend on you? Will you be our face and our voice to hold the line against the sheriff's union and to make sure that SB 54 is not watered down? Senator, can we count on you? Can we count on you, sir?
Kreiner was referring to the California State Sheriff's Association, which is fighting the measure that would, with some exceptions, ban state and local law enforcement from cooperating with federal immigration authorities. DeLeon chose his words carefully.
We're going to count on each other to work together.
Did you catch that at the very end? You can just barely hear a guy in the crowd call DeLeon's response a very political answer. So a few minutes later, Kreiner tried again.
Senator, can we get a yes? Will you represent us?
We need a yes!
We got a yes!
Except the question DeLeon said yes to was, will you represent us? Afterwards, the pro tem confirmed he did not agree to block further amendments to the bill.
Flexibility is what legislators need to have space, to room to negotiate.
The political reality, DeLeon pointed out, is that bills need a certain number of votes to pass.
We are still having very constructive dialogues with law enforcement community, and particularly the chiefs of police.
But earlier in the day, in a blow to the bill's prospects, the California Police Chiefs Association had just formally come out in opposition after previously staying neutral in hopes of reaching a deal with DeLeon. The group says although police don't have any desire to enforce immigration laws, the bill would create roadblocks, hurdles, and ambiguity to doing their jobs. And that shows why DeLeon couldn't promise the crowd he won't take further amendments. He simply doesn't have the votes. As an urgency measure, SB 54 requires two-thirds approval in both houses of the legislature. That means every Democrat in the Senate and all but one in the Assembly. But although they declined to give their names to avoid upsetting the powerful pro tem, the offices of three Democratic senators tell Capitol Public Radio their members aren't there yet. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
This is Valley Edition. People love seeing black bears when they visit places like Yosemite National Park. They're powerful creatures that can be docile or ferocious, depending on the encounter. But in such a highly visited place, incidents with bears are bound to happen. And as FM89's Ezra David Romero reports, the park has come up with a new plan to keep bears and people safe.
It's Fresno State student Kyung Cheng's fifth time to Yosemite National Park. He and his friends are walking along the lower Yosemite Falls Trail. He still hasn't seen a bear yet, but if he does, he says he has a plan.
If they appear, I would love to, you know, see them. I probably would just quietly, like, just observe them and take a picture.
That's exactly what park officials want people to do, to keep a healthy distance away from them. But training the public to think this way hasn't been easy, says NPS spokesman Scott Gettiman. In fact, in 1998, there were almost 1,600 human encounters with bears where people were injured or property was damaged. Today, there's less than 100 a year thanks to the Keep Bears Wild program launched almost two decades ago. They still want to get that number lower.
It was not atypical to have three or four vehicles broken into every night. We wanted to put the responsibility on the park visitors to store their food properly.
Gettiman says there were so many encounters with bears because in the park's early history, the rangers managed bears very differently from today. There were bear feeding areas and dumps in the park where people watched bears devour piles of trash and food. NPS wildlife biologist Ryan Leahy runs the bear program in Yosemite.
Bleachers were even set up. Meanwhile, during this whole thing, bear conflict was starting to occur outside of these feeding shows. You're starting to have habituated bears, bears that have lost their natural fear.
He says all that human interaction resulted in having to kill bears in the name of public safety, and it taught bears to gorge on chips and trash. In turn, they taught their cubs to do the same. So Leahy says decades later, bears still crave human food. He says managing the 300 to 500 bears today in the park is very different, thanks to technology. It all started with the bear box. That's a metal box with a door and latch where you can store food and smelly products like deodorant.
You can see this plate right here prevents a bear from getting its hand in there, but your fingers are thin enough that you can.
The first few renditions of the bear box didn't work well, but now a new design with a push from below type lever is in use all across the park. His team also tracks bears using GPS collars, and if one gets too close to people, they can scare it away, catch it in a bear trap, or relocate the animal. But he says it wasn't always so easy to track bears. They use radio telemetry collars and tags on them. That's where they collar them, and then they can hear a beeping sound on a radio unit when close to one.
So we're using these radio telemetry devices to track those bears in the night before they enter these developments.
All this technology has also helped reduce the number of human encounters with bears. Now they're using advances in technology to bring those numbers down even further. Over the last year, Leahy's been working on a pilot project where he can track the bears that live in the park in real time on an iPad or computer using frequencies from the GPS-collared animals.
Yeah, it looks like all the bears have gone into their dens. Apparently, that last storm pushed them in.
He can now immediately tell if a bear is getting too close to, say, a camping area. The data he's retrieved from this program points to another trend. Bears are being hit by cars, and speeding is now the biggest threat to bears here. He says about 30 were hit last year, and 10 died.
You're talking about 10% of our bears potentially being hit by vehicles each year. Just slowing down a little bit will give you that stopping distance required to prevent a collision.
In response, his team has created an interactive map-based website where people can see the general areas where bears are hit the most and where bears live. It's also a place where park visitors can learn all about how to be safe if a bear is around.
Since you're a little kid, you get driven into Yogi and Boo Boo. Yogi and Boo Boo is not what these bears are. So what we want to do with this website in a positive way is engage people before they get here. Hey, here's the real story about black bears in Yosemite National Park.
The website goes live in early April, and Leahy hopes the educational site means fewer midnight calls with a dented car and either a dead or wounded bear. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. This week, we continue our coverage of the GOP plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Last week, we heard from Anthony Wright of Health Access about his concerns with the so-called American Health Care Act. Today on our program, we're speaking with someone who had a hand in crafting the new plan. Lonnie Chen is a Stanford University law professor and research fellow at the Hoover Institution, and he's been an informal advisor to the Republicans writing the American Health Care Act. On today's show, he's speaking with FM89's Carrie Klein.
Lonnie Chen, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the basics. Why did Republicans want to change the Affordable Care Act?
I think Republicans had several concerns about the Affordable Care Act. First of all, I think they were concerned about the increasing federalization of healthcare policy, the specific determinations, for example, about what every single health plan in the U.S. had to cover that were being dictated and made by the federal government and through federal policy. Trying to reverse some of that, I think, was the first element. But the second element, which I think has garnered more attention and is certainly related to the first in my mind, are some of the challenges around cost that have been created by the Affordable Care Act, how we've seen consistently increasing premiums, particularly on individual markets through the exchanges that were set up by the Affordable Care Act, the average increase in the average, what is known as silver plan, for example, between 2016 and 2017 was 25%. So some of those cost increases, I think, have been very problematic. So if I had to highlight two significant issues with the ACA, I would certainly start there.
And then there's the cost to the federal government as well.
Right. There's a question regarding the fiscal sustainability of something, for example, like the expansion of Medicaid, which is the program designed to cover low-income Americans, and that was significantly expanded by the ACA there's some question around the fiscal sustainability of that particular entitlement expansion.
Right. And when we talk about decreasing the federalization then of health care, you've argued a lot that this plan allows states more flexibility in how they provide coverage. So what does flexibility mean in this context? What sorts of programs would states be able to do that they can't do now?
Well, I think there's a few issues at play. First of all, the American Health Care Act, which is the proposal that Republicans are advancing, would give states greater flexibility and also funding around questions of how to cover those who have pre-existing conditions. You know, one of the issues around the Affordable Care Act is, yes, it does require insurance companies to essentially offer insurance to anybody who shows up, regardless of health status. Now, by the way, that doesn't change with the American Health Care Act. But one of the issues that was being created by that requirement is that because folks were then signing up for coverage, they were driving up health care costs for those who did not necessarily have pre-existing conditions or who may have been younger and healthier who were buying health care on Obamacare's exchanges. And so one of the things that the American Health Care Act does is to give states the funding, but also the flexibility to provide additional assistance in the form of, some have said, for example, the form of a high-risk pool, which would essentially be a separate pool of coverage for people who have pre-existing conditions, the idea being that you help them with their costs, and therefore, if you pull them out of the normal marketplace, you lower costs for everybody else. Those kinds of arrangements were not necessarily permissible, nor were they funded under the Affordable Care Act, certainly once it got fully implemented. So I think that's one example. A second example would be greater flexibility for states to design Medicaid programs that rely more, for example, on things like managed care or putting additional requirements on people who are involved in the Medicaid program. Those are things that currently are not permissible under federal law that I think the American Health Care Act seeks to change.
There's also been a lot of talk about a single payer system. Is that another one of these options that states might be able to play around with?
Well, I think it is the case, first of all, that if you have a federalist system of government like we do in the U.S., where states are sort of seen as the laboratories of democracy, you do want states to be able to engage in experimentation and to have healthcare solutions that might be different from those of their neighbors or from other states. I think a big question will be what the guardrails will be for those sorts of plans. So, for example, as you note, if California made the decision that they wanted to go to a single-payer healthcare system, is that something potentially they could do? And the argument from a federalist point of view, I think, would be that if a state wants to pursue an option like that, they ought to be able to have the freedom and flexibility to do so. Now, will that actually be the case under this administration? We'll have to see. But actually, within the Affordable Care Act, there is a provision that would permit states to do that kind of experimentation. And that provision is not going away with the repeal of the Affordable Care Act that the Republicans are currently trying to do, because remember, Republicans can't actually repeal the entirety of the ACA through the process they're using, only pieces of it.
Well, you mentioned that provision that states would be able to use to enact some of this flexibility, but very few of them actually took advantage of that under the Affordable Care Act, right?
That's absolutely right. So, you know, you have a few limited examples. Hawaii took advantage of the provision. It's contained in Section 1332 of the ACA. Hawaii took advantage of it to retain a longstanding employer mandate they had in that state. Vermont actually tried to use it to implement a single-payer system, but they found as they began to put the system together that the economics were very difficult and they couldn't make it work. So you're right. Not that many states have taken advantage of it, but I suspect as we go forward that more states can and will take advantage of it if they are given the flexibility to pursue a variety of different options, such as if California wanted to pursue something very drastically different from, let's say, what someone in Texas wanted to pursue.
And when we're talking about state flexibility also over time, I mean, they're afforded kind of this more freedom to design the programs they want, but over time, they're going to have less money from the federal government than they would have had under the Affordable Care Act, correct?
Well, this is specific to the Medicaid piece. So, you know, with Medicaid as an example, there could be greater flexibility within Medicaid. The question is going to be how the funding formula will change. Remember, what Republicans are trying to do is to convert Medicaid from essentially an open-ended entitlement, which is what it is today, into a system of defined contribution grants to the states. And those grants are scheduled to vary based on how many patients a particular state has in its Medicaid program and the acuity or the health status of those patients. So the amount of money could vary from what it is today. In some cases, it will be less. And so states are going to have to figure out how that will square with their own priorities as they seek, in some cases, to keep coverage going to the same number of people. That may be very fiscally difficult for some states in certain situations.
So let's talk about Medicaid then. A lot of criticism of the Affordable Care Act focused on, you know, particularly the individual mandate and the exchanges. So why then was the restructuring of the Medicaid program such a big priority for the AHCA?
That's a good question. So Medicaid is one of those major cost drivers as we look at the federal budget going forward. The biggest drivers of federal spending as we look over the next 10 years are Medicaid, Medicare, and the major health care programs like the subsidies created by the Affordable Care Act, by the ACA. And so Medicaid has always been an entitlement program that Republicans have believed is in need of reform. Now, part of it is because of this argument around fiscal sustainability, the challenge that the program would continue to place on the federal budget going forward. But another part of it, as we've already alluded to, is that the way that federal law is written now, states don't have a lot of opportunity for flexibility unless they ask Washington first for permission to do it through something known as the waiver process. There's actually a section in the Medicaid Act, Section 1115, that gives states the option of asking for the ability to opt out of certain requirements in the Medicaid law in return for this ability to be more flexible. So Republicans have always felt that that kind of mother may I approach was the wrong way to handle Medicaid, that states should be presumptively allowed to craft the programs that suit their states best. So there's really two reasons why Medicaid has been such a target. One, as I noted, is the fiscal issue, but the second is the program design issue and how to make Medicaid a more efficient but also more innovative program.
And so when we talk about Medicaid enrollment, what then will be the guidelines for enrolling in Medicaid? Will they go back to what they were pre-Affordable Care Act, or will it be completely up to the states? How will that work?
Well, currently, the way the AHCA is written, the expanded Medicaid rules, essentially what the Obamacare did, what the ACA did, was to expand Medicaid eligibility to anybody making less than 138% of the federal poverty line. And it used to be the case when the program was first created way back in the 60s and 70s, it was a program targeted at single moms and their kids. So the program has grown dramatically over time. Obamacare, the ACA expanded it significantly. And then now the big question there is going to be around whether that expanded eligibility will be allowed to continue. So what the AHCA does, what the Republican alternative does, is to continue allowing for that expanded population to continue enrolling in Medicaid through 2020, at which point eligibility will revert back to the pre-ACA, the pre-Obamacare rules. Now, whether that is actually what's going to stick or not is an open question, because one of the changes that Republicans are considering now to their bill is to shut off enrollment in Medicaid a little bit earlier under the expanded rules in 2020. So we'll have to see where that all goes. But at the end of the day, the idea, yes, is to return Medicaid to its traditional enrollment requirements.
Okay, and acknowledging that things could change within the AHCA in the near future, under the current plan, the Medicaid expansion would time out in 2020. What happens to those who are enrolled now or who continue to enroll until that date? How would their timeout work?
Well, I think there's a couple of issues. So first of all, for those people who are already in the program, there is contemplation about potentially allowing them to remain in the program, obviously subject to the state having the funding to keep them in the program, which is an open question in terms of how the state wants to make a decision. So, for example, if the state after 2020 ends up getting less money because of this new system, the state would have to make a decision. Do they want to continue to fund everybody who's enrolled in their Medicaid program, in which case the state's going to have to make some trade-offs in its own budget? Or does it want to take eligibility down such that people who may have been eligible under Obamacare are not going to be eligible any longer. I think some of that will be left to states. But more broadly speaking, the idea is then for those folks who were on Medicaid to provide them with assistance in the form of a tax credit, which hopefully will be more generous than is currently specified in the bill itself. But the idea is to give them a tax credit to help them afford coverage on the private market. And furthermore, there is something called a state stability fund, which is being created to kick additional money to the states to give people, again, more assistance as they try to buy insurance on the private marketplace if, in fact, they no longer are able to get coverage through Medicaid. So the idea is to create a little bit of a safety net around those who may, in fact, no longer be eligible for Medicaid because of the changes that are contemplated in the Republican bill.
All right. And then let's talk about, Trump's original campaign promises around the American Health Care Act, about his repeal plan for the Affordable Care Act. And so, you know, he really emphasized the two points of affordability and access. And of course, the CBO's report came out last week, which estimated that 24 million people would lose health care coverage in the next 5 years. How does President Trump plan to maintain that coverage?
Well, to be clear, what the CBO report said is that 24 million fewer people would be covered compared to the baseline of where the Affordable Care Act is going. So that's an important distinction to draw. What I would say is that he's going to have to figure out if he wants to maintain this promise of actually having a healthcare law that expands access, they're going to have to look more carefully at, for example, creating a more generous tax credit or subsidy for those who are low income, potentially thinking about additional changes to the Medicaid reforms they've talked about so that you might have an even longer runway, or you might have situations where states get a grandfathered level of assistance for those who are on Medicaid. There's all sorts of different ways that they can tweak the coverage number. On the cost number, I do think it's the case that the CBO report actually found that in the long run, so beyond 2020, premiums will actually decline under the Republican plan, and in fact, costs become more affordable. So that is something that I think the Trump administration and congressional Republicans have continued to point to as they've said that they believe their approach is the right one, that in fact, the goal of getting costs down is something that this plan actually does achieve, particularly as you look beyond 2020.
So in California, the Affordable Care Act has had a huge impact, particularly the Medicaid expansion. Throughout the U.S., around 20% of Americans are enrolled in Medicaid. It's closer to a third here in California. Of course, Medicaid here is called Medi-Cal. What do you expect to happen to all of those Medi-Cal enrollees?
Well, for many Medi-Cal enrollees who, for example, were eligible under the original law even before the ACA, they'll continue to be eligible, and I don't anticipate that too much will change. I think the question will be for those people who did gain access to Medi-Cal under the ACA, what's going to happen? And I think the answer is twofold. One is the state could make the decision to make a much larger investment in its own budget toward the Medi-Cal program. Now, the state already spends a lot of money on Medi-Cal, and I think many state policymakers believe there's not a lot of slack there. But they could make the decision to take money from other parts of the budget, for example, from corrections or from environmental issues or from infrastructure to pay for additional people on Medicaid. The state could always make that decision and essentially hold harmless, based on any changes that are made in federal law, those who've been added to Medicaid. It could also be the case that the state will need to make decisions regarding funding for some but not for others. And I think those are the kinds of difficult decisions that, frankly, states have not had to make that they are probably going to be confronted with as we go forward as the funding model for Medicaid changes. Now, hopefully, California will be able to get even additional flexibility in implementing its own program through the passage of the AHCA. That remains to be seen. But the bottom line is this. The state is going to have to make some fiscal decisions going forward about how to deal with its Medicaid program, which is already a very, very large component of state spending.
And so this plan has gotten a lot of criticism from the left, of course, but also many conservatives. It's been called Obamacare Light or Obamacare 2.0. But you argue that there's really a lot here that conservatives can get behind. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think conservatives, you know, their concerns largely are focused on three things. They would love to see more repeal of some of the insurance regulations in Obamacare. The challenge is that as I've referred to several times, there is this reconciliation process they're going through, and there's only so much they can repeal through that process for a variety of procedural reasons and sort of legislative precedent that dictates what they can and can't do. And so, you know, Republicans would like to see more aggressive action on that, and that's just simply not something that's in the cards given the process that's being used. The second thing is, I think a lot of Republicans don't like the idea of the creation of a tax credit to help those who are in the low-income uninsured category. They view it as the creation of a new entitlement. From my perspective, we use the tax code for lots of different things, and certainly the notion of providing some assistance to those who have not done as well and who need assistance to get coverage, I think, is a perfectly reasonable thing to do. The third issue is a lot of Republican conservative folks wish that the Medicaid changes were being accelerated. As we mentioned earlier, a lot of these Medicaid changes aren't happening till 2020. They'd like to see that date moved up. And so that's why some have derisively referred to the legislation in the ways that you've indicated. I frankly think that a lot of folks ought to, you know, folks who are conservatives who express these points of view ought to take a much closer look at the things the legislation actually does, because in fact it implements a number of reforms that conservatives have been talking about for some time. For example, the Medicaid changes we've been talking about, these are things that Republicans have been talking about for easily the last two decades. And so there's a number of changes in there that I do think make the policy fundamentally quite conservative. As I said, I think there are elements of the bill that are not quite perfect. They're not the way that I would want them. But certainly as a template and a framework, it is something that is preferable to what we have currently under the Affordable Care Act.
So the bill is expected to go up for a House vote later this week. What do you expect to happen there and in the coming weeks?
I expect that there will be some changes made to the bill on Wednesday of this week as the bill goes before the House Rules Committee, which is the last step before it reaches the floor of the U.S. House. And then on Thursday, my sense is there will be a vote on the bill and that the level of support, at least amongst the level of support necessary in the House, will be there for the bill. I think that with the changes that are made in the Rules Committee, there will be the necessary number of votes to get the American Health Care Act across the finish line in the United States House of Representatives. And then the question becomes, what happens to the bill when it goes to the Senate? It's a very different political dynamic. There's more moderates in the Senate, and so they potentially could have an influence in terms of bringing the legislation back to the left, if you will, to the extent that the bill goes in a more conservative direction to get through the House. It's possible it will become a more moderate or a more liberal bill as it comes back into the Senate. We'll have to see how that dynamic plays out. But obviously, the politics are very complicated on this as we go forward.
Yes, indeed. Well, Lan He Chen, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. There are some new developments in the unfolding story of alleged misuse of a confidential law enforcement database by members of the Kern High School Police Department and administration, and the case may be headed to court. Here to tell us more is Bakersfield, Californian reporter Harold Pierce, who broke the story. Harold, welcome back to Valley Edition.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me.
So this time the story centers around former District Police Chief Joe Laptege. He's filed a lawsuit against the district. What's going on here? A $100 million figure. Something sounds pretty serious.
He's actually still the police chief over the Kern High School District, but he is on administrative leave right now. And while on leave, he's on a medical stress leave, and he's filed a pretty sizable civil suit late Friday evening. And his lawyers are saying it's worth about $100 million in damages. And just to catch everybody up, Joseph Laptege is the whistleblowing police chief who discovered that over at Kern High School District, his bosses were misusing the sensitive police database called the California Law Enforcement Telecommunication System to essentially run background checks and rap sheets on students, job candidates, anybody who they really wanted to.
So he's saying that he was a whistleblower and he has been retaliated against by the district and has suffered harm. Has there been any investigation into that at this point?
There's been a lot of investigation at this point, and the investigation has cleared him of any wrongdoing, and that's what the Tulare County District Attorney's Office has come back and said. And they had investigated this, I think, a few months ago, because this is a guy who used to work for the current county sheriff's office, and the DA had a conflict of interest in investigating it, and so did the sheriff's office. So got bounced over to Tulare, and they said they had no problem with his using the Klutz the way he did, and that's simply because he was using it to run a background check on his stepson, who worked at the district, who he knew to be a heroin user, and he was afraid that he had a warrant open for his arrest. So he had another officer check the system for any open arrest warrants. And so that's where this this allegation comes that current high school district officials had made. It was actually Mike Zulfa, a member of the superintendency, who had filed a sheriff's report against Lopetegui in August after he'd gone on administrative leave, after he had turned in the district for this alleged Klutz misuse. And what Zulfa had alleged is that he was misusing it himself, that the whistleblower was in fact the one who was misusing it.
So is that the center of the claim of retaliation, or are there other things that Lopetegui is saying that the district did made a hostile work environment?
That's the center of the claim for retaliation, but they also claim in here that that Joseph Lopetegui was tailed by his own officers, that they surveyed him, and you know, there's also another related issue right now. Gerald Wyatt, another one of the officers who had investigated Klutz under Joseph Lopetegui at the district, he's also on administrative leave right now, and he was surveyed himself by Dave Edmiston, another officer who was acting chief at the time after Lopetegui got on leave. I know there's a lot of players here, so it's tough to keep track, but that particular individual right now is facing eavesdropping charges.
So let's take a step back. What is the deal with Klutz? Why is this a big deal? How are law enforcement agencies supposed to use this? And what are they supposed to use it for? What aren't they supposed to use it for? I guess on the surface, a police department running these checks is somewhat routine, but I guess that's not what happened in this case.
It's a big deal, Joe. It's, you know, these are things that are a need-to-know, right-to-know basis for police officers. When they run a Klutz check and they run a rap sheet on somebody, they better have a good reason for doing that. And if they don't, they can get into a lot of trouble. They can't just arbitrarily run these checks. And a rap sheet is a big deal, especially if you are, say, a teacher who's applying for a job over at the current high school district and district officials decide to run a rap sheet or a Klutz check on you, and they take a look and they see that you've been, let's say, arrested for a crime, but you were never convicted. Well, that's something that would never come up in a normal background check that the district would be available to them. But it does come up in a rap sheet, right? So that's a big deal, and that's essentially what Lopetegui's lawyers are saying is a constitutional violation of these people's civil rights.
So what's the deal with these Rambo squads? That's kind of a salacious term, but it comes from the district, I understand.
That's what they called themselves. And this is a really interesting aspect. This is really what's at the heart of this whole Klutz scandal, is this idea that the district athletics department was wanting to keep teams from getting stacked with talented players. So in an effort to kind of try to control that, they would hear that, say, you know, Jane Doe was out there playing, you know, soccer at Highland, but her parents lived in a different district. Maybe they were split up. And basically it was a way for them to go ahead and check license plates. This Rambo squad would go out. They would check the practice, get all the license plates of the cars that were there, run the Klutz checks on these car license plates, trace them back to where they lived, and they would make sure they're living in the proper high school boundaries so that they weren't, you know, playing for teams that, you know, were that potentially had better scholarship opportunities. Like Highland, for instance, had better scholarship opportunities than, you know, Frontier or something like that, right? So it's a way for them to kind of keep those teams from getting stacked or potentially stack those teams.
How widespread was this practice? Do we know?
You know, this is a decades-long practice, is what Lopetegui's lawyers are saying. This thing goes back as far back as the records they have indicate, and that goes back to about 97 or 98. And they have so far found at least 3,000 rap sheets, and on average, about 250 of these license plate DMV checks every year since 1998.
So
that's 3,000 people whose rights were potentially violated, 3,000 people who could potentially file suits themselves against the current high school district.
If this is such a big deal, why haven't we seen criminal charges yet against some of those involved, aside from the investigation into Lopetegui, which cleared him?
You know, it's a really good question. The Kern County DA had declined to press charges. They cited a lapse statute of limitations and a lack of evidence. You know, I think that if you talk to Lopetegui's lawyers, they'll say that it was simply too great of a challenge for them to take on. This thing is massive. You know, if you've got 33,000 rap sheets that have been run potentially illegally, and on top of that, 250 DMV checks every year for, you know, 19 years, 20 years, that's a big caseload.
Do we know how many of those cases where they ran those background checks might have been in circumstances where maybe they shouldn't have done that, or versus legitimate uses of CLETs?
There's no indication at this point how many of those were legitimate and how many of those were in fact illegal. But I think that Lopetegui's lawyers at this point are looking at it from the standpoint that probably the great majority of these are an improper misuse or an improper use of CLETs, particularly for those rap sheets. I just don't know. I'm not quite clear what the possible justification for running rap sheets on students would be.
And when it comes to the district, what are they saying right now as far as this case, first of all, but then the larger issue of these practices?
Not much, Joe. They've been pretty tight-lipped about that. And they actually, we spoke to their lawyer yesterday, their defense attorney, Arnold Antridoki, and he had said that his ethics are barring him from speaking about this case because he doesn't want to try it in the media, doesn't want to taint the jury pool. So they're keeping pretty quiet about this particular case. Overall, in terms of the CLETs misuse, when this became public in August, they took some actions. You know, Brian Schaefer, the superintendent, he took civilian oversight of the district, which some folks say he's not even allowed to do legally, but I think that's up to a court's interpretation at this point. They hired a Chicago-based outfit to come in and determine best practices for that police department. They hired a Sacramento-based firm with no price ceiling at all to come in and leave no stone unturned, and they're investigating this as a third party, is what the district has said. So they're going to be looking at this, and you know, we've pressed the district at this point and asked them if given the great public interest in this particular situation, if they would release the results of that investigation and the conclusions of that investigation. And at this point, they've not said whether they will or not, and it's still ongoing.
Real quick, are the Rambo squads still ongoing?
At this point, it's unclear.
Very interesting. We'll have to read more of the Californian and Harold Pierce's excellent reporting on this unfolding story of alleged misuse of confidential law enforcement information by members of the Kern High School District. Harold Pierce with the Bakersfield, California, joining us today on Valley Edition. Harold, thanks.
Thanks, Joe.
Well, I'm going to California.
It might be the most famous boxcar in Kern County. The childhood home of the late country music star Merle Haggard is no longer in Oildale, where it sat for 70 years. It's now at the Kern Pioneer Village, and the museum is throwing a party to celebrate its renovation next month. Joining us now is Grace Martin, coordinator of something called Boxcar Fest. Grace, welcome.
Good morning.
So tell us, what has been going on since the boxcar was moved to the museum site and renovations began? Where does it stand right now?
Yeah, sure. So we moved the boxcar here in the summer of 2015. And since then, our team, our staff here at the museum, along with some help from some outside people, have been working to curate it and get it ready to show everyone and to give tours. And the culmination of that is Sunday, April 9th with the Haggard Boxcar Festival.
So you have family, friends, and much more all coming out to the Pioneer Village to celebrate. Tell us what's going to be happening at Boxcar Fest.
Yeah, so Sunday, April 9th, the event is from noon to 6. The gates will open at 11:30. We will have some really great performances by Ben and Noel Haggard featuring The Strangers, Johnny Owens and the Buck Fever Band, and James Carruthers. That'll be our main stage lineup. And then around the grounds. We've got some really great porches that lend themselves really nicely to having some other live music acts. So we've got some people from around the community and around the county that are going to perform on some other porches around town. So, and then of course we'll have the tours of the boxcar and tours of our permanent Bakersfield Sound exhibit as well.
How challenging has it been to renovate the boxcar, and what state are officials trying to renovate it into? As it was a home, as it was originally a boxcar before the Haggard family moved in, tell me a little more about the restoration process, if you can.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So our curator, Lori Ware, is recreating the boxcar to look the way that it looked in the late 1930s and 40s. So it would have been as it was a house during Merle's childhood. And like you said, family Lillian Haggard has been very instrumental in helping us with that, as well as Taylor Loudon. We've hired a historical architect to really make sure that we're doing this right. And then the Cynthia Lake Charitable Trust. All of those players have just been very instrumental in helping us get it restored to the 1930s and 40s.
So how far along is that work right now?
We're almost finished. We're going to be done by April 9th. So they're wallpapering and painting and putting the final touches on. Pretty soon we'll start moving the artifacts in and you know, just finishing it up, getting it ready for people to actually walk through on the 9th.
Obviously, Merle would have loved to have been there to see it unveiled. He passed away last
yes.
year, but he did get to see the boxcar being moved to the village. Just tell me about that if you can.
Yeah, so he was out here. They moved it, I think it was July of 2015. And I wasn't here at the time, but I've heard stories and, you know, Lillian shared stories with us, and he was out here in a black leather jacket in the heat of July. But yeah, it was a proud moment for everyone.
Yeah, and certainly a proud moment for the entire community at Kern Pioneer
yes.
Village Boxcar Festival coming up April 9th. If people want more information, what can they do?
They can visit the festival website, which is boxcarfest.org, or they can visit the museum website, which is kernpioneer.org. Tickets are $20. They can be purchased over the phone by calling 661-437-3330.
Sounds great. Looking forward to it. Again, Grace Martin, coordinator of Boxcar Fest at the Kern Pioneer Village, April 9th. Grace, thanks so much.
Yes, thank you.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. For our producer and reporter, Ezra David Romero, our audio engineer, Marv Allen, production and operations manager, Don Weaver, and reporters Jeffrey Hess and Kerry Klein, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.